Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham, and delighted to welcome our guest, Hall of Fame quarterback and award-winning broadcaster, Troy Aikman. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to give the audience a little peek behind the curtain. One of the most challenging things to do when you're having a private, public, in-depth conversation like this is to have a conversation with someone you know really well.
That's right.
Because I've got to ask you things that you'll be interested in answering. Otherwise, you're gone. If I can keep you interested, everybody else is going to
have a good time. Think you're going to do?
We're going to find out. We're about to find out, because I'm confident that if I'm not doing well, you're going to let me know.
Might be a short podcast.
It might be. It might be. So let's start off with this. What's the best and worst thing about being Troy Aikman?
Oh, man. Well, that's a good question. I don't think there's much that's bad. I will say that. I think, you know, it's good. I've been afforded a lot of opportunities to do some fun things that, you know, or experience them in ways that I otherwise wouldn't have gotten to, whether it's the Masters, the Indianapolis 500, the Kentucky Derby, you know, locally, sporting events, you know, Super Bowls, you name it. You know, that stuff has been pretty awesome. And I guess, you know, and just trying to be as realistic about it as I can, I think, you know, whatever negatives there would be would be just when you would kind of like a little anonymity. You know, you and I have laughed about this. The great Gary Busey once told me that, you know, hey, it comes with the dinner. And I've always remembered that. And I think no matter where you are in life, there's always some real positives that you can gain about your life, and there's always some things you'd say, I wish it was maybe a little bit different. I don't know that anybody lives in a vacuum to where every single element of their being is positive and as they would wish that it would be. So, you know, I'm not any different, but yet I'm very grateful because, you know, I had dreams and aspirations as a young boy, and I've realized those dreams, and my life has been far better and richer than I ever could have imagined.
How many of those dreams involved playing baseball?
When I was young, they all involved baseball. I really thought, Brad, that's what I ultimately was going to do was play baseball, at least collegiately, and then felt that I'd get an opportunity to play professionally. And I feel that had I stayed in California, that likely would have happened. I think that, you know, I had skills that would have allowed me that opportunity. But when we moved to Oklahoma, the baseball program just simply wasn't as good. There wasn't as much attention to it. And then the focus became more of football. But as a sophomore, I almost gave up football altogether. I was just going to play baseball and basketball. And then it would have been real interesting to see, you know, what might have happened in my career. I will say
weren't
that
you drafted in baseball?
I wasn't. The Mets, a number of professional teams were looking at me, but the Mets were the team that was most interested, and I kept putting them off because it had been instilled in me by my parents that I was going to go to college, and I just felt that I'm going to college. I never really considered bypassing college, going right from high school to the minor leagues in baseball. But yet, if I wanted to do that, my parents were such, especially my father, that, you know, he was going to let me do whatever I wanted to do. But I kept putting them off. I just wanted to be able to say, you know, 30 years later, when I was doing a podcast with Brad Sham, that I was drafted, is what I wanted to be able to say. And they called me the night before the draft, the Mets did, and they said, what's it going to take? Because I'd already committed to OU to play football. And I said, $250,000, and Daryl Strawberry at the time was their big slugger, and the guy said, what, 200, you know, Daryl Strawberry doesn't even make $250,000, and I said, well, that's what it's going to take if you want me, and it was a short conversation. He says, well, you have a nice career at Oklahoma.
And what would your position have been?
They were looking at me as an outfielder or a catcher. And the problem was, I'd played catcher a little bit. I never played in the outfield. I was a shortstop, you know, throughout my baseball career and pitcher. But that's what they thought I was too tall to be a shortstop. Cal Ripken was the only guy really of my size that was having success as an interior infielder. The problem with being an outfielder was I wasn't hitting with enough power. You know, they want home run hitters. And I thought I was that until, until they worked me out. And apparently they didn't think I had enough power to really play in the outfield. So who, you know, My guess is I would have been a welder with my father somewhere had I have continued to go down the baseball route.
I'm going to give people a little bit of an insight into something that most of them don't know about you, and it may be one of the reasons why you don't find many negatives. Although some people might say, what's he got to complain about? But but everybody's got something to complain about if they want to. How long have you been meditating?
About 4 years.
And how'd you get going with that?
There's a guy named Dan Harris who is a broadcaster for ABC News. And I'm not even real certain how I came across his book. And it was titled 10% Happier. And I think however I stumbled across it on iTunes looking for a book to read, the name kind of just grabbed my attention. And then I started reading, and I'd kind of, when I first got an interest in meditating or, you know, Zen or mindfulness, however, you know, you want to go with it, was when I read a book called Sacred Hoops by Phil Jackson. It's one of the best books I'd read, and he talked about his meditating and Zen, and, you know, and I found it interesting. I found it to be something that maybe, you know, I needed to learn more about, but I never really pursued it, but it's always been in the back of my mind. And then I read this 10% Happier and became really intrigued, and I began my practice then. And I've now been on a couple of retreats, and, you know, I have a regular practice, and I feel that it has really helped me in a lot of ways. And I really wish that I had picked it up when I was much younger. I wish that I had started when I was in my 20s. And I think that had I have started when I was much younger, I think I would have been a different teammate. I think I would have been a different player. And not necessarily in a bad way or a better. I think I just would have handled situations a lot better, and probably not have allowed frustration to set in with me the way that it did. But it's still an ongoing, you know, it's the Jason Garrett, you know, term. It's a process, and you never really get where you want to go, but it's been very helpful in my life.
People really hate the fact that phrase is so accurate about so much of life, but it all is a process.
Yeah.
How would you describe your meditation practice?
I would describe it as, you know, I do about 20 minutes a day. I went to a retreat recently. It was a 10-day retreat, and it was the most intense thing that I've ever done. And I didn't know it at the time, but I found out later I did not stay for the 10 days. I left after 3 days, and I felt like I had really accomplished a great deal. How anyone could stay for 10 days is beyond me, but it was about 16, 17 hours a day of meditation, and, you know, it was a silent retreat. But it opened up some, I think it kind of broke some walls down for me, some barriers, and helped kind of advance my practice to another level, to where I'm able to sit longer and be a little more focused than what I once was. And I think it's like anything in life that you get out of it what you put into it, and I try to put as much into it as I can.
How much of your meditation is walking meditations? When you say sit, people who don't meditate have visions of you sitting going
right,
with your fingers together.
Right.
Sometimes you do that, but
that's
sometimes
right.
But that's not all that you do, right?
No, it's not all you do. But at this particular retreat, which was in Kaufman, Texas, of all places, it was close. It was all on the mat. You know, there was no walking meditation. There was no working meditation. Now, I did a retreat, a 3-day retreat, in Northern California at Spirit Rock a couple years ago, and it did incorporate walking and working and basically just being mindful throughout the day of everything that you're doing. And I think I was better equipped for that. I don't think I was quite ready for, you know, that number of hours, you know, on a mat with your eyes closed. But this Vipassana approach in Kaufman was such a intense workshop that it peels back the layers pretty quickly, and you get pretty raw. And I have never felt loneliness, isolation the way that I did in those 3 days. And my wife went with me, and she has really no meditation practice to speak of. And I was really worried about her, couldn't check on her, couldn't talk. And I know how isolated I felt. And I'm thinking, I can only imagine what she's going through. And then when I got word to her, like, I'm leaving, she was actually doing very well. And I was really proud of her. And I feel bad that I kind of pulled her away from something that I think
she went with you. I was going to say, did she say, I'll see you at home?
She, you know, like a good wife, she left with me, you know. She wasn't going to stay behind. But
she knows the guy she married.
Yeah. Well, she does. In fact, Brad, that we were talking before we got there, and one of our kids said, hey, Dad, do you think you're gonna stay for the 10 days? And I said, oh yeah, absolutely. And they said, really? And I said, I've never quit anything in my life. I mean, I'll absolutely be there for 10 days. And I will tell you, it disappoints me I didn't stay. But she just knew there was no way I was leaving early. So she went in with a little different mindset, thinking I'm in it for the 10 days. Whereas for me, my car was parked right out in that parking lot, and I knew I was 45 minutes away from Dallas, and I could leave whenever I was ready. And I was ready after 3 days.
When you picked up the Phil Jackson book, which kind of opened the door to this meditation practice for you, what was going on? Now, I know you've always been a voracious reader, but what drew you to that?
I don't know. I think I think it was just Phil Jackson that brought me to the book. Didn't really know much about his coaching philosophy. And this goes way back. This goes back to his days with the Bulls. And maybe at that time he had only won two or three world championships. You know, I mean, he wasn't the Phil Jackson that he is now. But what I really loved about that book was that I don't like reading sports books when it rehashes all of the games. I want to know about the person, and I want some, you know, depth to it. And I thought his book really provided that. And so it was his way of coaching. It was his way of bringing the team together. And he would hand out these books to various players, you know, on what he thought that they needed or what he thought might inspire them. And I just found it fascinating, and I read some books that, Zen and Motorcycle?
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Repair.
There you go. And so I read that and read some others, and then through reading this book, 10% Happier, with Dan Harris, I reached out to Dan Harris, got in touch with him. He turned me on to a couple gurus that he's been working with. I emailed them, and so it's been really enlightening for me to be able to, you know, confide and then have people who really understand the practice who have been able to help me. But I was pretty young back when I read Phil Jackson's book.
Some people just heard you say that, and they heard the inspiration that you got from Dan Harris's book. And I heard, I just reached out to him, and he put me in touch with it. Sometimes it's good to be Troy Aikman.
Well, that is one of the benefits. And I reached out to them when I left this retreat, and because I was beating myself up pretty good, mm-hmm. and you learn that that's not one of the things you should be doing, and I
beating think yourself
that,
up.
Yeah, and they put it in real good perspective for me, and I think that we're all in a place where we should be at the right time, and there was a reason why I went, there was a reason why I left when I did.
Didn't beating yourself up when you didn't meet your own levels of expectation have a lot to do with what fueled your athletic success?
Yes. Yeah, I think that it's been rewarding. It's been helpful in my athletic endeavors, and then I think in a lot of ways it's also been part of my downfall or frustration, if you will. I think that unfortunately for me, I want to be, you know, I know perfect's not attainable, but I expect to be just short of perfect in virtually everything that I do. And yet I know that I have real shortcomings, and I know there are things that I'm not great at, you know, that I don't excel at things that I wish I did. So it puts a lot of pressure then to always feel like, you know, you have to be better than just your best. And so that's something that I've kind of had to deal with a little bit, you know, and it's not something that bogs me down, but it's just through, I think, my time of meditating that I've been able to just kind of uncover some things that maybe have been hindrances for me.
So some of that drive, I would guess, is what led a lot of people in your early days in Dallas to think that you just were never happy. People who didn't know you, they just saw you. How many times did you hear that in the early 90s? Why didn't he ever smile? Why didn't he ever happy?
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, And
by the way, part of the question is, in fact, there were plenty of times when you were very happy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm generally happy. You know, I mean, I'm generally a happy guy, but I don't walk around with smiles on my face. I mean, I will say that. I think people may just see me and think, oh, he's unhappy when I'm not unhappy at all. It's just, you know, it goes back to when I was a kid. I just wasn't one of these kids who ran around with smiles on my face. But I feel like I'm generally a very happy person. But I also can get real frustrated and agitated when things aren't done at a level that I expect. And unfortunately for me, about the last 4 or 5 years of my career, nothing was being done the way that I expected. And so those were tough years for me. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of frustration. And it boiled over daily. And it was something where I had to really contend with each morning. I'd wake up and say, okay, you know, I'm not going to let this bother me today. I'm going to fight through it and be positive. And then, you know, within an hour of walking into that building, something would happen.
That was the last 4 or 5 years of your career. And it was also true the first couple of years of your career. Did you think before Norv Turner got
somewhere
here,
in there were some good years?
Yes, we're going to get to those. Before you met Norv Turner, you really didn't have any idea if you had any kind of a professional future, did you? And you certainly didn't think you had one here.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that I do feel that I always believed that I was going to have a good career. I didn't know if it'd be a great career, but I always felt that I was going to have a career that I could look back on and be proud of. Did not in those early years say, I'm going to have a Hall of Fame career. And didn't say that I'm going to win 3 Super Bowls. I always did, however, believe I would win a Super Bowl. But the first couple of years, yeah, were really challenging. They were tough. I was tested in a lot of ways. And as you well know, and there was a time where I did not think it was going to happen in Dallas. I thought that, okay, well, you know, maybe it's best that I go somewhere else. And then, of course, Norv Turner comes in 91. And it wasn't just for me. It was Michael Irvin will tell you, Emmitt Smith will say it, Mark Stemnoski, Darryl Johnston, a number of guys will say that as good as Jimmy was at orchestrating the team and the drafts and the putting together the players, you know, Norv, without him, I don't think we would go on and do what we did. And it was just a perfect fit between him and Jimmy. But it made me realize, Brad, that I believe there are a lot of quarterbacks out there that have come into the league, recent years or even long before, that were really talented. But they got in bad situations, and they couldn't get away from them. And had I not have gotten away from what was a bad situation for me when I first got here, my career would have looked entirely differently. And that's why Norv inducted me into the Hall of Fame, because I think he, without question, was the one guy who turned my career around.
Were you then surprised that at some point while you were playing that people started talking about you as a Hall of Fame player, since it wasn't something you necessarily thought of when you came in?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's a kind of a strange thing. I never went into the, you know, some guys do. I didn't. I went into the league wanting to be the best ever. You know, I mean, I really did. I think most people feel that way. But it wasn't the Hall of Fame. I guess if you are the best ever, then you will be in the Hall of Fame. But saying I want to be in the Hall of Fame was not a real priority. I wanted to go win a Super Bowl. And we did that, of course. And then the next year when we were getting ready to play in the Super Bowl, I remember you came up to me and you said, you know, when you win multiple Super Bowls, you know, you kind of paved your path to Canton. And that was the first time I'd ever remembered thinking like that. And I thought, you know, you might be right. If you win 2, it's a pretty good chance you're going to get in. And, you know, and then I ended up winning 3. And when the time comes around after 5 years when you've retired, I was very proud of my career and very happy with what I'd accomplished. But now 5 years, when you become eligible, everybody wants to tell you why your career wasn't so great. And I thought, gosh, I mean, this what a terrible process this is. That
In fact, you weren't sure you were going to get in that year.
When I retired, I was certain I was going to get in.
At some point?
No, I was pretty certain I'd be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Okay.
But when that fifth year came up, just – the way the talk was going, then I started thinking, you got to be kidding me. I've been a first ballot Hall of Famer for the last 4 years. And now all of a sudden the fifth year that I'm eligible, they're saying. So I just think that I don't like the process. I really don't. I just don't like the way they go about doing it. I'm very proud of my career. There are those, because of social media, I get a chance to read a bunch of the comments that think that, well, he only threw for 20 touchdowns once in a season, or he only did this, or he only did that. And to me, I really, when I see those comments, I think those people that are making those comments, I just think they're losers. Because I won, you know, and that's what you get paid to do, and that's what I got paid to do. And I don't care if I threw a one-yard touchdown pass or if Emmitt Smith ran a one-yard touchdown. It was a touchdown, and it counted 7 points for our team. And, you know, so the statistics, and I really don't take offense. I do not take offense to those critics that are there, but to me, they miss the boat. I think they just miss why it is a team sport and why we play the game. And so I really am able to dismiss those criticisms very easily.
You talked about wanting to be the best ever, and I would love to have your thoughts about this, because the rules of the game have changed so much over time. When people, now everyone just knows that Tom Brady's the best quarterback that ever lived, and maybe he is. But most of those people never heard of Otto Graham.
Right.
And I don't know how you can differentiate, I don't know, but you're a Hall of Fame quarterback, maybe you can tell us. How do you say, well, I know that Tom Brady was better than Otto Graham, but not as good as Joe Montana?
Yeah, I don't think you can. And you're right. Otto Graham is the guy who gets lost in it all. I mean, for what he accomplished and was able to do, I just think that as we move through time, it's the most recent that we then are calling the greatest. And, you know, when Peyton Manning retired, he was the greatest. And when John Elway retired, he was the greatest. Well, now Tom Brady's the greatest. And eventually he'll retire and someone else will continue to do what they do. And all that's fine. I think it makes for a good discussion and good debate. You know, I've always said that Joe Montana was the greatest because I watched him play in my era, and I knew right away how difficult the game was to play at the level in which he was playing it. The game has certainly changed. I don't think you can look at numbers and say, oh, well, this guy put up these numbers, therefore he's better than the guy who didn't put up as good enough. You can't compare eras. I mean, it's completely different. It's not even close. But I do think when you're talking about world championships, that's a whole different deal. I mean, that I did say we did the game when Tom Brady won his fifth Super Bowl, and I did say on the air in the post game that I've always said Joe Montana is the greatest, but I think I'm going to have to change that. I think it's Tom Brady, and I really do.
Well, and he might be.
Yeah.
It's a tough thing to prove. Something else you said a minute ago intrigues me all the time, and that is social media, at which you are very adept. Anyone who is not following Troy on Instagram and Twitter is missing a bet.
I don't feel like I'm...
I know you don't.
And you obviously don't know my colleague, Aaron Andrews, because you talk about adept.
Well,
or Deion Sanders.
Yeah, no. Adept only means you're good at it. It doesn't mean prolific. It just means adept. However, I think a lot about how life would have been different if social media had been prevalent when you played, when Michael Irvin played, when a number of your teammates, how would it have been different?
Well, I think it would have been different in the way in which it's different now. You know, I just think that I'm trying to think what it might have been, what was relevant when I was playing that wasn't around back when Staubach was playing, and the technology. I mean, technology has continued to move forward. I can't think of anything that was readily out there. The camera phones weren't available just yet. And then it went from camera phones where you could video everything, and that kind of put people on notice. And then with the social media, now, you know, not only are you potentially in a video in a compromised position, but now it's being shared with millions of people, you know, around the country. And so I just think that it brings, And I've always said social media is a race to the bottom. I mean, it really is. It's pretty funny, really. I get in the car after a game and I start reading some of these comments that are on my Twitter feed, and I read them to Joe, and it just pains him to no end.
Well, I mean, now Joe Buck is really sensitive to that stuff, isn't he?
Well,
and I love
Joe. I think
Joe.
Everyone's sensitive, but I do think that for me, when you've played quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys for 12 years, you know, whether there was social media then or not, you still hear the critics. You know, I mean, they have a way to get to you. So I just think that it would have made people more aware of their surroundings and what they were doing. And so I don't think it, you know, yeah, I think that if you're talking about my group of guys, that, yeah, it would have been, if they had continued to do some of the things that they were doing and social media was out there, not good. But I think that everyone gets smart and you say, hey, you just can't simply do these things, you know, if these things are available. And I'm not saying they're doing anything that was illegal or, you know, they're just, you know, when you're young, I think we all tended at some point in our lives to do something that was fun
and stupid.
Harmless,
yeah.
And stupid and you hoped like hell no one else heard about it. You know, whereas social media, everyone gets to hear about
it. Yeah. By the way, in the course of that answer, I hope everyone, including and especially Joe Buck, paid attention to how adroitly Troy steered the question completely away from Joe's sensitivity to social media. We moved on from that.
Well, I do laugh when I'm in the car and I say, hey, Joe, listen to this one. And I'll read it. And I start laughing and I don't get anything out of him. He's in the front seat. And then I'll say, oh, this one's even better. Listen to this one. And he's like, would you please stop reading those to me? And I said, come on, Joe. It's, you know, we don't even know who these people are. What do we care? But it can if you're not careful. I mean, I think you would probably agree.
Absolutely.
There's no one in the public eye, especially as broadcasters, that when they're doing a game, they're getting hammered. You know, people don't like it. And, you know, no one, you know, it's too easy to be negative. No one wants to take the time to say, oh, boy, Aikman might be the greatest broadcaster that we've ever listened to. You know, I mean, you don't get many of those, right? So it's all pretty critical. And I think that I can honestly say, it doesn't impact me one bit. Now, when I was playing and articles were written, you try not to let that bother you. But I would tell you that, yeah, some of those stung a little bit. And I didn't like reading them and they would upset me. But social media does not bother me. What I really try to do, sometimes somebody writes something and I'll say, you know what, I think he's right. I think that, you know, his point about what I did there or didn't do this. So I try to use it as a bit of constructive criticism, too.
How do you factor into your commentary opinions about today's athletes who go in at halftime and read their Twitter feed and react and maybe react on the field?
I don't get it. I really don't. And I don't know anyone who would be my age or older that could understand it. I don't want to be the old guy who says, you know, oh, you know, that's not right. There's no way. But, you know, I think that if I was a coach, I'd say, all right, look, we're not going to be on the phones at halftime, you know. But yet, that's such a big part of these kids' world, you know. And I don't know. I think I'd want to sit down really with.
Does it hurt you to say these kids? Talk about the players?
A little bit. You know, a little bit. Yeah. These kids are just a little older than my kids, you know.
Yeah.
But I think it would be a discussion. I think it'd be one of those where I'd really want to understand it, because the one change that I've seen is the athletes coming in, they want to be a brand before they want to be a teammate, and they want to be a brand before they are part of a good team. And that bothers me a little bit. You know, it bothers me a lot, to be honest with you. It just is kind of the way that it is. And I think if you're going to coach and you're going to be around these athletes, you got to learn to accept. I think part of being a great leader is you have to find what motivates somebody and then use that in the context of how you want them to be. And if being a brand is somehow important to them, all right, well, let's figure out how we make you a brand, but yet you're going to be a great teammate. So I wouldn't be quick to just say, no, we're not going to do it. But when guys are firing off tweets at halftime, ripping people who have ripped them because they dropped the ball in the first half, I don't quite follow that one.
How do you handle social media as a father?
Pretty well, I think. But I also would be the first to say, I don't have my head in the sand, but I'm not as vigilant with my girls' social media accounts as I probably should be. And part of that is that we all think we have the greatest kids, and our kids could never do anything wrong. But with that being, I really do have great kids.
and they couldn't do anything wrong.
It is too much. It is too much. Now, I'm not on Snapchat. I can't follow them around everywhere. And I refuse to get on. I'm only on a few, you know, Instagram, Twitter. I've kind of given up Facebook. And I follow them on that. I see what they're posting.
That's good, because the Russians are all involved with that. You know?
And we talk about it, but I just hope they're making good decisions, and I trust that they are. But it's scary. It is scary out there with social media and young kids, especially young girls.
How do you convince them what you try to convince Joe Buck, that the things that people put out there about them, about their father? You're recently married. I'm sure there were some things. How do you convince them that that's not anything they need to worry about?
Yeah, we have not. There's been a couple instances where some people have been rude and disrespectful to my girls on a social post. And they get blocked. On Instagram, they get blocked. On Twitter, I don't put much on there with my girls. You know, it's no holds barred on Twitter. I mean, I let everybody do what they want to do. But on Instagram, my kids see that, and I share more of my personal life in that. It's unacceptable. But I've been fortunate that there hasn't been any attacks in that way. But yeah, they'll see something that somebody says about me, which will be an attack, and they're like, "Dad, did you see that?" They're appalled. They're like, "How can you know they're, you know, they're just not used to, you know, they'll get cynical soon enough, you know. I mean, they hadn't hit them yet, but I just tell them, hey, just, you know, you don't worry about it. It's all part of it. It's part of being in a public figure, and so they seem to digest it all pretty well.
Anybody who knows you understands the pride that you take in your performance, in your team, in your teammates. I think it's one of your best qualities, and I don't know, as long as I've known you, that I have ever seen a greater manifestation of pride than the pride you feel in being a father and of your daughters. How have their lives informed the way you live yours and being their dad?
Yeah, it's been the greatest thing in my life. I mean, I think most, if not all, fathers would say that. You know, I wanted to be a professional athlete, as we talked about earlier, and I wanted to be the best I could be. And now, that is so far removed from what I want to be remembered for. And I understand I will be, but my girls are going to be the ones, in my opinion, that pass along my legacy. They're going to be the ones who tell my story. It's not going to be the Dallas Cowboys. It's not going to be Canton, Ohio. It's not going to be some fan who saw me play in 1991. And it's my girls. And there are going to be those stories from those people. But the only one to me that matters is what my girls say. And so it there's tremendous responsibility with that. I take it very, very seriously, and I try to be the best father that I can be, and I know that I come up short, and I know I have, you know, shortcomings. But I just wake up each day trying to, you know, do it the best way I can. And those people listening that have kids, many of whom do, you realize that there is no, you know, there is no guide to doing it. You just go on your instincts and what you feel is right. When girls feel it, when you feel like they need a hug and need a little bit more of your attention, and that's the way that I've kind of done it. You know, I asked my girls just last night. I said, "Hey, you know, I'm just wondering. You know, we got married, we got a blended family, and do you need more of me? Am I giving you all that you need? Because I don't know that I am. And they said, Dad, we're great. You're doing awesome. And I said, okay, well, let's tackle tomorrow, you know, and see where it goes. And so it's been really, really good. I mean, you know, my circumstances are a little bit different, and it's been a really great thing for me and my girls to be able to spend the kind of time that I have with them, to be able to have retired when they were born. And, you know, I've gotten to do all the things that a lot of dads don't get to do because they're working. So I'm really, really proud of them, as you well know, and it's the greatest thing in my life.
So you played 12 years professional football. I think we established earlier six of them were absolutely miserable, and six of them were happy and delirious. And you've now, I always marvel at this, you've now been a television broadcaster longer than you played.
Yeah.
17 years?
17.
17 years. Is that divided up into the really terrible years?
No,
and really good?
No.
Or have these been all pretty good?
No, it's been really good. I was so fortunate. My first year, I got into a booth with Darryl Johnston and Dick Stockton, and to have a guy like Dick who had been around the business for so long, and he was very, very helpful, and he was very much a mentor and a father type figure, whereas he would be the first to admit earlier in his career he wasn't, and I hit him at the right time. And then to be in the booth with someone who was one of your trusted teammates and the guy you just respect the hell out of, you know, it was a lot of fun. And then I moved into a three-man booth with the number one crew the following year with Joe Buck and Chris Collinsworth. And I learned a lot from Chris. You know, he was more of a polished broadcaster at the time I started working with him. And I learned things that I otherwise wouldn't have gotten to learn. And then was with him 3 years and then he left, so now we just finished my 13th year with Joe and I alone in a two-man booth with the number one crew, and I'm thrilled to be doing it. It's a terrific job. You do start wondering, you know, gosh, how long does this? You know, there's always new guys coming in. There's always another slew of players who are a little bit more relevant to the game than what you were, and. You know, so you just take it one year at a time and see what happens. But I never dreamt that I would be doing it this long. I really thought, Brad, when I got into it, I'll do it for a few years, figure out really what I want to do. And I always kind of thought I'd get involved in a front office. And there's a part of me that still kind of thinks that I will. I do think there's one more frontier for me, and I just don't know what that is. I'm trying to figure that out. You know, the kids will be out of the house here within about 4 years, but at that time, I'll be 55 years old, and you can't take on something new at 55 because they don't want to invest the kind of time in you at that age to teach you what you need to know. So you got to be smart about it, but I do think there's something left for me, and if there's not. I'd be a little disappointed when I look back. So what that means, I really don't know.
Well, it means in part that it wouldn't be consistent with who you are if there wasn't something about which you could be a little disappointed. But
yeah.
but what it also means is, and you can just ponder this, that you may think 55 is too old to start, or you may think that other people think that 55 is too old to start. But that might not be true if you're Troy Aikman.
Well, I do know that I'm a quick learner. And you know, so there's more to that there's more to this conversation. I you know, Rich Dalrymple, the PR director for the Cowboys, we were talking about this one day, and he said, do you really think at your age, when your kids go off to college, that you're going to want to go stand out there and watch football practices every single day and be in an office and watch film? And because I have had a life in broadcasting that has afforded me the opportunity to pretty much do it the way I want to do it each day and how I prepare and how I study. And there's something to be said for that. And I did learn in the car business when I had the Ford dealership and I was in there every single day, sun up to sundown, and then broadcasting on the weekends, that after about 3 years of that, I said, you know what, I kind of like that life I had before, and I'm going to go back to it. And so I think you do have to be smart about it. So I don't know. I think that's the one thing, you know, put in that perspective. Yeah. do I want to be beholden to a boss and to a job that requires a lot more time than I'm currently giving? And I think the answer to that is yes. You know, I think I want the challenge, and I think I want the challenge of wins and losses once again. But whether or not it will present itself is, you know, it's one thing to want something, it's another thing to have it happen. But what I almost said earlier in this podcast is that there's been very few things in my life that if I set my mind to it and said, this is what I want for my life to be, this is who I want my life to be with, that those things have happened. So I'm a really big believer in visualization and then making it happen. So we'll see.
When you are 5 years into that successful new chapter, then we're going to sit down and review it again.
Perfect.
Thanks for the time.
Absolutely.
That's Troy Aikman. This is Then and Now.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.